there's so much out there now, and there's so much that is disappearing really quickly, that if we don't act fast enough, those histories will be lost. And we've already lost a lot of those histories.
Welcome to Conversations in Game Studies, a series of podcast talks with scholars who research video games in their academic work. As usual, I'm your host Adam Houchedi, coming to you from Central European University in Vienna. And today, I'm welcoming back Chris J. Young from the University of Toronto's Mississauga campus, where Chris works as head of collections and digital scholarship. We spoke with Chris about his research into the Unity video game engine and its significance for the indie scene about a year and a half ago. And back then, the University of Toronto had actually just acquired an enormous archive called the Sid Bolton Collection, with around 14,000 video games and hundreds of consoles and systems and other peripherals. Since then, this collection has been expanded even further with the Personal Computer Museum collection and the Electronic Playground Media Records. So I was curious to invite Chris back for a talk about the challenges and opportunities that come with curating such a massive video game and hardware collection at a university library. So with that, Chris, thank you for joining me again, and it's really nice to have you back.
Yeah, thank you for having me, Adam. It's wonderful to be back.
Maybe let's start with your position. You are head of collections and digital scholarship. How does the position relate to or interact with these massive collections that you have at the U of T? So what do you do, basically?
Yeah, so part of my job is curating and managing the archives and special collections that are specifically located at the Mississauga campus within the University of Toronto system. We have a couple of areas that we uniquely provide here to support unique programming here, but that it also complements what may be offered on our other campuses and other libraries. So one of those programs is game studies. And so my role in curating and managing the Sid Bolton collection is to ensure that we have preservation and conservation practices in place so that these materials will hopefully last a long time, or at least longer than if they're circulating in the general public, and then ensuring that there's some sort of level of access to these media and technologies. And I say some sort of access because some systems are a bit more precarious and have different sorts of proprietary technological challenges than others. But our hope is that these, you know, ultimately all go into the hands of the students to use in their curriculum, their learning experiences, and then any sort of research projects they have as well. If those end up benefiting public researchers and other folks who are interested in working with those materials, that's an added bonus for us.
So speaking of those challenges, let's take it maybe from the beginning. The Bolton Collection came to the university in 2022, if I'm correct, and it was donated to the University of Toronto by the widow of avid video game collector Sid Bolton, who passed away in 2018. How long did it take to catalog this massive collection? And given that most libraries are probably not really that well prepared for dealing with video games, were there any unique challenges that you faced in just cataloging this immense amount of hardware and software?
Yes, many challenges. I would say that we're still cataloging it. So what we've done, because it's such an enormous collection, is work at creating a finding aid, which is basically a list that includes some essential bibliographical information. So this can include things like the title, the system it's on, the date it was released, and then any unique aspects of, say, one copy over another. So many folks will be familiar with the standard release of a video game, but then there's also things like collectors or limited editions. So when we have multiple copies of the same game, we'll make a note just to say if there's any important distinction there. So it's not full level cataloging like you might see in a university library catalog or a public library catalog, but it's enough for us to know what copies we have versus others. So until we're able to do a much more rigorous full level cataloging of these items, we at least know what we have, so that if we decide we want to go out and purchase or acquire additional materials, or we're lucky enough to have donors who have games that they're willing to give to us, we at least know what we have or what's a duplicate.
And did the collection actually come with some sort of catalog of its own? Because if I remember correctly, Sid Bolton used to have a museum of his own before he passed away. So I guess he also kept some sort of records.
I guess he had some sort of records because he would have known, I guess, for his collecting purposes. But it was after he passed, a volunteer at the museum went and created a list because they needed to be able to send it on to organizations like ours who might be interested in taking it on. So we had a generic list of title and the system those games were on. So that's how we came to that sort of rounded figure of around 14,000 games, was based on that initial list. But it wasn't ideal in the sense of how we would curate and manage it for access, you know, what we would share with the public to know what we have. So we use that list as a way to gauge, okay, we have over 2,000 PlayStation 2 titles, but then we only have 506 Action Max titles, which was a VHS-based game system in the 1980s. So it gave us a sense of like, okay, there's over like 50 different video game systems here. We have approximately this number of titles for each one. And then from that, we were then able to add more additional information that will be useful for researchers, students who are looking to retrieve a specific title on a certain system.
Was probably sounded like a great opportunity acquiring this collection, but was it maybe also daunting? Because I imagine that maybe not all libraries are totally confident in being equipped to deal with video games.
I would say I'm not that confident either. To answer your question directly, yes, it's daunting, but video games are one of the most important mediums of our time at the moment, you know, like print, like books, like film, music, you know, games are right up there. You know, people have used financial data to measure the gross revenue and value of the industry. But I think if we look at it from a more subjective cultural standpoint, in terms of its contribution to the arts, to technology, to society, it's important that there's collections out there that, you know, researchers in the future can understand. You know, how are we at this juncture of certain kinds of business models that seem to dominate film, games, you know, with the subscription model? Like a lot of those were developed with games decades ago. Some of the handheld technologies and games as well, you know, were very much used and influenced the way that smartphones and mobile phones have been designed. So understanding those aspects of the medium itself, I think, is really important. And so that, to me, even though it's extremely daunting, is a motivation for why we should be doing this work. You know, it is hard work. I would say arguably it is harder than some of the more traditional special collections around print. Different challenges, of course, but there's a well-established tradition of practices around cataloging and describing and conserving and preserving those materials when compared to games. Like, we're not reinventing the wheel, so to speak, but we're having to look at what hobbyists have been doing in the community, what the few other institutions in this area are doing, and then looking at how can we adapt those and modify them according to our own institutional needs. So that's the bit that makes it harder, I think, and one that, you know, my colleagues and I, we find daunting, but we also relish that we have that sort of opportunity to be, you know, one of the first institutions here in Canada, at least, to be actively doing this type of work.
And I imagine that those blueprints then served as very useful guides in how to set up your procedures of how the games can be accessed. So even though you mentioned that the cataloging process is still ongoing and that there are some limitations, can you describe, if a student wants to play research a PlayStation 1 era game, how would it look like physically, this process?
That's a great question. So we have for all of our special collections, we have a research request form that folks fill out, and then we book an appointment with them to make a visit. Hopefully in the future, we'll be staffed well enough that we can have opening hours. So if someone drops by, they can put in a request then and maybe be able to retrieve it quicker. But for now, we have to rely on this process. So once they put in that request, we reach out to them. We let them know if we have the game, if it's in working order, and then arrange a time for them to come and use the materials. So when they visit our reading room in the library, this is a closed space, partly because of the value of many of the materials in there. And it's a controlled space in the sense of we control the security in there to avoid potential theft, although we hope that never happens. Conservation issues around food and drink, so people can't bring food and drink in there. People are allowed to bring their phones. We encourage them to take photos because it's an experience, but also they might need to document things for research purposes or to refer to when they go home. So when we set up the system for them, we have a range of stations where we swap in and swap out the different technology depending on what it is that's being requested. So if we're looking at a Super Nintendo system, we'll connect it to one of our CRTs, so one of the tube televisions we have, to try and maximize the authentic experience for the researcher. And then we get it started for them and operate it for them. So what that means is that we insert the cartridge, we turn it on, we make sure it gets to the menu system, and then we hand over the controller to the student or the researcher. One thing that we've done to mitigate potential damage to the system is that every time we interact with it, we potentially do damage, whether or not we intend to or not. And so the most direct way that damage could occur is through the controller. So fortunately, there's a number of contemporary third-party vendors that manufacture controllers that pretty much replicate almost exactly what the original controllers would do. So we purchase a range of these whenever they're available. And then that's how people will play with the games. If they want to use an original one, we can, of course, put that in there for them. But this is one of the ways that we can kind of mitigate potential damage. And that's also worked really well when we've done events, you know, with students or the public, because people drop controllers occasionally or whatever it is. So that's one way we try to avoid damage. But apart from that, like, anyone can make a request, they can come in and use any game in our listing.
It sounds like a pretty complex ecosystem where you as the staff has to have a lot of familiarity with the systems themselves. And my next question is related to that. Is it a problem to maintain or even get some of the older systems working if we're talking about hardware that is several decades old?
Absolutely. Many of them right now don't work. So when I say that, it's with the caveat of these systems perhaps being some of the more esoteric ones that folks haven't heard of. And there are reasons for that. Some of that is there are fewer of them available because they weren't as well known. Some of them aren't as well known because they were faulty to begin with. Let's just say they were designed well, but the technology parts that went into that design haven't operated as well together. So then that means we have a system that's quite rare, but then also isn't working for various reasons that have less to do with age and more to do with how it was constructed at the time. You know, we've all come across faulty products and technologies, and games are no different.
There's value in having these objects, mm-hmm. even if they don't work to a certain extent, just having the hardware or the specific blueprint if somebody's interested in it as a curiosity, right?
Yes, exactly. Like one, for example, I mentioned it earlier, the Action Max, which I had never heard of until it was in this collection, but it was a VHS-based game. So it was a little console that plugged into your VHS deck. The game itself was a VHS tape, and you put it in there. So you can imagine where issues and faultiness is going to happen with this, because VHS is analog. It's on a sort of spool reel. And so depending on what play you have, whether or not it's cleaned or not, could cause damage, create static, that kind of thing to the tape. So yeah, there's those challenges. So we explain this to people, and we can also show them how it would look, even if we don't operate it. But yeah, we also have systems where, through various reasons of age and so forth, they just need a little bit of conservation treatment. And so some of those can be repaired, no problem. We just haven't got around to it yet. I feel confident just about every system in our collection could be operational if we had the time to get it ready. But that's also why we're looking to the future in terms of how can we preserve these games so that we're not entirely reliant on the original technology to put it in the hands of, say, a student or a researcher.
I imagine that despite any hiccups or limitations, it has been pretty popular. And I've also seen that the University of Toronto organized several game days where people were introduced to the collection. So can you talk a little bit about what the reception has been like for having the essentially biggest video game collection at a university in Canada?
Yeah, it's been a mixture of surprise and awe. I'd say most people's reaction is, oh, wow, the university has that. That's awesome. Because they're sort of surprised that video games would be part of the curriculum and part of what we would consider as a legitimate form of study. It's not that people don't think it should be. It's just, as you know, we discussed earlier, right? Like, not many institutions are doing this. So there's a mixture of that sort of surprise, but also awe that we're undertaking this work. Yeah, we've tried to do a number of public events for a few reasons. One is to promote the game studies program we have and promote the collection. But the second one, and perhaps the most important one, is to let people know that we have this. When we do it, we'll have some of these games out for people to play, to look at. But we also, you know, we're there to let them know that, hey, if you're interested in using this, you can make a request and come and make a visit and use some of these materials. So, you know, we're in our first sort of year of the game studies program, and the first couple years since we've really been open providing access to the collection. So we're very much in that early stage of just creating an awareness of our existence. We're not a museum in the sense of here is an exhibit display. We're very much sort of wanting to put these in the hands of people to be able to use and play.
And this game studies minor program has launched last year. So how exactly does the collection factor into that? Will it be a part of the core course curriculum, or is it something that students can additionally visit or research if they want to?
We're working with a few faculty at the moment in particular. So we, I guess, on the lighter end of their interaction with the collection, it could just be a class visit. You know, let's go visit the archive and take a look at some of the game systems. On the more integrated side, it may be a workshop. We actually have later on today one of those sessions where it's 2 hours. We have a number of stations set up in the library for groups to interact with. And then at the end of that, they'll present on their findings. So we have like a game, we'll have a system, we'll have a few magazines relating to the context in which that game was released. And then they have to answer a number of questions and do essentially primary resource research. And then on the more integrated end, students may also have assignments with these materials. So we have courses where students have to pick a game or a game object, like a system or a controller, and write essentially a research essay on that object. And because we're covering roughly 50 years of game history, we have some of the more recent items, so that can work well with, say, communication culture programs that are working at, say, more contemporary, in-the-moment topics, but also some of the more historical base courses that you might see in, say, English and drama or departments of history. So we were able to provide a range of supports, and depending on what the instructor wants to do, it could be on that one end of the spectrum from a visit all the way to designing an assignment that really uses the materials.
So far, observing the patrons and students using the game systems, is it something intuitive if somebody starts using a 20, 30-year-old console hardware or some sort of computer hardware? If you play today, do your skills transfer, or are there some very, very quirky and unique systems where people are completely lost?
We have some classes where we have tutorials visit. So it's students from the same course, but they're from different sections of that course. And the experiences are always wildly different. Part of that is due to some students having less familiarity even with contemporary games, but also, as you were saying, like less familiarity with these older systems. I find it fascinating, some of them, because we're dealing primarily with 17 to 21-year-olds who, for the most part, were born post 2000. So the earliest console system they'd be familiar with, potentially, like would have interacted with at home, would be things like the PlayStation 2, the Nintendo GameCube or Wii, Microsoft Xbox. But the Nintendo Entertainment System and Sega Dreamcast and stuff are things that are foreign to them. So we usually have to provide a level of light instruction on how to use it. But even then, there's things, there was one student who touched the CRT television and they're like, oh my God, this gives off static, which, you know, to me and anyone over the age of, say, 25 would be quite familiar with. But for some of these students, they've only known flat screens. You know, they're not used to that static that gets generated from the cathode ray. So yeah, it's fascinating. And I think it also just adds a level of joy for us when working with the students, because we can explain, you know, this is how it was operating, this is why it works the way it does. And so sometimes there's a connection there, say with analog controllers on the PlayStation 1, they still have that today on the PlayStation 5 controller. But when you're dealing with hitting a select button to, you know, navigate the menu system versus the arrow key, that can be a bit, it would feel counterintuitive to the student who's familiar with navigating with the arrow keys. It's fascinating. And I think it adds a bit of sort of awe to the students, right? To be like, oh, wow, like I didn't know that this is how these technologies operated. And these were the kind of games you could play 30 years ago. Yeah.
I think even for people who remember it, who have experienced it, those devices have disappeared. Even major channels like Digital Foundry are always reminiscing about technologies like CRT, how it compares to modern LCDs. So I imagine that playing the games in their authentic form on the original devices is also quite the experience for somebody who has done it 20, 30 years ago.
Yeah, there was a student actually who came in to do an assignment and they went and purchased, I can't remember the game title, but it was a Nintendo title. And it was one of those games that's available through the Nintendo Switch. So let's just say, for example, it was Super Mario Brothers 3. And so they played it on the Switch with the Switch device, but then they came in, used it on the NES with a tube television with an original Nintendo Entertainment System and controller. And the student was saying, this is a way better experience than on the Switch because that's the original system it was on. So things like the gameplay will slightly be different. So they just said, I can't remember the exact phrase they said, but it was something along the lines of the performance was better on this older system. So yeah, like even some of these games that were getting re-released to us, using them in the original environment can be quite rewarding for folks who take the opportunity to go and do that.
It sounds like an amazing time capsule. Could you also talk a little bit about the Computer Museum collection and the EB collection and whether these directly complement the Sid Bolton collection?
Game studies is one of our collecting areas. So that means we will try to acquire materials that, I guess, speak to what I would say are sort of the three main areas of study. So one would be the players, so studying like player practices. One would be the developers, you know, the people who are making the games. And then the last would be the objects themselves. We're building quite a robust collection around the object side of things, less so on the developer player side. But I think in the future, those could be areas that we expand into. When it comes to Personal Computer Museum and the EP Media Archive, the PC Museum sort of came with the Bolton collection. It was a museum that he himself ran for a number of years, but it had a very different legal status. So when we acquired the Bolton collection, they had said to us, oh, by the way, can you also take the PC Museum as well? And I said, well, we'll see. Like, it's nearly twice as big as the Bolton collection. And does it support our curriculum in the sense of game studies? So that one, because it was run by a charitable organization, had a slightly different legal status. So it took us about a year just to make sure it would be fine for us to accept it as a donation. I don't need to get into the tax law here, but basically it was fine to do that. And within that collection had, very similar to the Bolton collection, a range of the unique personal computers, you know, Radio Shack TRS-80s, Apple IIs, IBMs, you know, a range of these computers that some people will be familiar from the 80s and 90s. And then, of course, quite a number of software, but particularly games that would run on these computers. So we haven't started our processing of that yet, just because we're wrapping up the Bolton collection. But our hope with this one is that we'll be able to build a very complementary collection in the sense of it telling the computer game history next to the video game history. So that one we're very excited to work on, and I think could potentially have some hidden gems in there that will be very useful for researchers. And then the Electric Playground Archive. This collection is incredible. The Electric Playground was a television show that ran here in Canada from, I think, 1995 up until around 2016. They're still producing content as podcasts, as reviews and special features on YouTube, because this is just the way that communication of audiovisual content has changed in the last decade. But they essentially donated all the episodes, all of their spin-off shows, Reviews on the Run, which is basically if they were at E3, they were doing reviews at the time. And so they would just do a review of a game while they're on the stage floor at E3 or wherever they were based. So they had all these side ones. And then they also were hired to do a lot of documentaries for video games. For films, people will be familiar with the making of X film. They did a lot of that for a number of studios. They did it for a Metal Gear Solid game. Call of Duty, I think, was another one. But the main thing with this is that it's a unique archive of, I guess you could say, televised games journalism. But it also comes with the wider archive of all of the longer interviews and recorded footage that they used for these episodes. So when they have a 1 minute interview in the episode with Shigeru Miyamoto, who was the designer for Super Mario Bros., they have a much larger 30 minute interview there. They also have an interview with Hideo Kojima, who was the game designer for Metal Gear Solid, and a number of other titles, most recently being Death Stranding. They have like an interview with him, and then they also have him playing Metal Gear Solid for like an hour in these interviews. So there's this treasure trove there of contextual information that can complement the histories of these game objects. So someone could play a game and then look at how it was received at the time by watching a corresponding interview, or, you know, once we're able to digitize the archive, be able to see the full length interview or some of the other promotional materials in that archive that we've been able to digitize and provide access to.
Pre-YouTube era, it's fairly hard to find some of these older interviews that were only broadcast. So it sounds like also something that could be really well integrated into modern analyses of how games were made or retrospectives.
And some of these companies too, like Nintendo, for example, they used to be quite open to interviews. And a lot of these companies have become quite private in the sense that they're worried about spoilers coming out or leaks happening. And so how they communicate with the public is through PlayStation Showcase event or some other special thing. And when they do give out interviews, it's very scripted and restrictive. And so some of these interviews will potentially be a bit more open than perhaps we're used to with contemporary ones.
And speaking of that, since you are now a very, very experienced video game archivist, how do you view the modern trend of moving everything to online services, cloud, subscription, even though the systems are more or less compatible because modern consoles are really PC-based? Do you think that it may pose a challenge over time to keep some of our modern games for posterity that are launching only in digital-only versions because of budgetary concerns or because of not having a strong publisher behind them? Do you think that this may have an interesting ripple effect down the line? We always think that these things couldn't get lost, and then suddenly you read that 90% of the games released before 2010 are very, very hard to play because of the old systems or incompatibilities. Granted, that was a hardware incompatibility, but we don't know necessarily if something major will not shift on the software side either.
Yeah, I mean, if there's an issue that keeps me up at night around all this work, it's probably this one. There are, you know, these blockbuster experiences that players are getting come with these risks, you know, in terms of the longevity of making them accessible. These publishers are creating these enormous immersive experiences that require ridiculous amounts of server power to operate. And eventually players will move on to another game. And so then what happens? They're going to repurpose those servers for something else. And so that game, if it's online only, will cease to exist potentially within a few years of release. So it's for sure a massive problem. In terms of the challenges for us here in Canada, our colleagues in the US are a bit more ahead on this because of some of the institutions that have been doing this for a while, but also because they have mechanisms in place in the US where they can advocate every few years with the Copyright Office to have certain exemptions that can allow them to, say, bring a game back to life. If they wanted to bring a server back online outside of the publisher because they're trying to make it accessible, assuming they have the technical capacity to do that, they legally are allowed to do that. Here in Canada, we don't have any precedent from a fair dealing perspective. So fair dealing being Canada's version of fair use in the US. And I think similar to cases in Europe, we have no case law that says that we can break a digital lock for preservation or access purposes, even if it's for like a public institution, like a university or a library. And it's never been tabled when these things have been, when consultations have been done by the government, when they're looking to update the Copyright Act or Copyright Law. So it's very much a risk endeavor on our part. I think, you know, assuming we're able to get that type of flexibility to do that, I'm a bit more hopeful than that we can save some games. But I think games proliferated so much in the last 10 years, like when you look at mobile phones and other sorts of apps that have come around, that we've already lost a lot of that history. So I think probably what will be needed is a more sort of coordinated, concerted effort by us, by sibling organizations around the world, to carve out certain histories that we're looking to capture. So that could be for us, it could be Toronto, Ontario based games that are made. Ideally, it would be Canada, but do we have even the resources to do Canada? I don't know. But I think these are the kinds of questions that we have to figure out, because there's so much out there now. And there's so much that is disappearing really quickly that if we don't act fast enough, those histories will be lost. And we've already lost a lot of those histories. I have an older iPhone that has a game on it that I remember downloading and buying that was made in Toronto 8 years ago. And it's on that phone, and I've only kept that phone for that game. But you can't get it on the App Store anymore because the developer hasn't renewed their developer fee, or for whatever reasons. And so you can't get it except via my phone. I'm sure other phones have this game on it, but I'm keeping that phone because I think that game should be preserved because it took a very sort of unique take on Toronto's history mixed with a game. So I don't have a great answer to it, but I think it's probably the one thing. If there was anything that would keep me up at night, it would be this one.
The more games, the more challenging it becomes. And really, the disappearance of physical media is not helping at all. That's a pretty big shame, at least for the archiving. Is there anything that we missed, Chris, that you think we haven't mentioned regarding the collection? And if not, what are the future steps now for it? How is it moving forward?
Yeah, we've got to end on something hopeful, right? After the last question.
Exactly.
Yeah, so we're almost done listing the Bolton collection, then we'll move on to the PC Museum soon. We are soon to be digitizing materials within our collections. So we haven't got the go-ahead to do it in terms of breaking technological protection measures from our institution, but we are setting up our workflows and buying the equipment to be able to do that work. You know, once, probably in a year's time, I'll have a better answer to this question. But my hope is in a year's time, we have that go ahead. And if there are games that are particularly at risk, and by at risk, I mean at risk in our collection of deteriorating, but also have been identified as at risk by the wider community, and we happen to have one copy of this game that people have been searching for, then we'll look to preserve those games right away. There'll also be games that certain courses will heavily want integrated. And are there ways that we can provide controlled virtual access to this game so that 80 students can access it and not one at a time in our reading room? These are difficult questions to answer within our legal context, but that's sort of what I'm hopeful is that we'll move into a phase where, you know, we're controlling access, but we're doing it under the exceptions provided by our fair dealing, because it's only fair that folks get to play these games.
That is indeed a positive end. It's time is of the essence as well with archiving always. So thank you very much, Chris, for shedding light on the Bolton collection and really keeping my fingers crossed with the digitization process. And it will be great to hear what the U of T is up to with its expanding game studies program and also with the collections themselves. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Adam. Very happy to chat about this.